Hi, this is Jenny Chamberlain, and welcome to my Southern Utah Housing Podcast. This season, we're talking about attainable housing.
Today, I'm really excited because I'm going to have a special guest. It's my dad. His name is John Brammel. He is the former mayor of Hurricane. He spent a lot of time serving our community, so I just want to hear his thoughts and about where things were, and then we'll look forward to a future episode where we're going to interview the current mayor as well. So it'll give us a little bit of a history on some of the subjects that I've been interested in talking about. So welcome, former Mayor Brammel, to the podcast.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi. So you served Hurricane City for a long time. Can you tell us what offices you served in and how long you served? Just a little bit of history there.
Yeah, I started on the Planning Commission under Tom Hershey and with Doug Garner back in 1998 through 2000. Then I ran for City Council in 2000 and was on the Hurricane City Council from 2000 through 2013, two or three terms as two-year City Council and a couple of terms as a four-year council member. And then in 2014, I ran for mayor and 2013, I ran for mayor and was a mayor from the 2014 through 2021 inclusive.
And then you finished serving?
In January of 2022.
Okay. So just recently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what first motivated you to run? Well, it sounds like you served on the Planning Commission before. What made you motivated to serve the community that way before you ran?
Two people. One is a man named Gordon B. Hinckley, who in October of 1997 said, "We would encourage many of you individuals to get involved in local community political things and planning and zoning and serve on city councils and mayors." And then Tom Hershey was on the Planning Commission at the time and said, "Hey, Brammel, you ought to come serve with us on the Planning Commission." So I got involved that way.
Cool. So
the other reason I got involved is when I was a Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, I took a pledge to do my duty to God and my country and to my community.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the Scout promises to do. So I fulfilled that commitment that I made as a child.
That's great. So one of the things I've been talking about in this podcast is affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
And how it kind of, and sometimes it ends up overlapping with short-term rentals, because when they're used up as short-term rentals, you can't use them as long-term. I was curious, because you served for a long time, like, was short-term rental controversy a thing when you first started, or did it come up later? Like, what's a little bit of the history of, as far as your experience?
It came up later because I was involved long enough that back in 98 to 2000, no one knew what Airbnb was. No one mm-hmm. knew what overnight rentals were.
Mm-hmm.
They happened in Europe. They happened in places that had been settled for 2,000 years, but they were not. Back then, it was a bed and breakfast,
mm-hmm.
and we had maybe four in all of the 3,500 homes in Hurricane at the time that were called bed and breakfasts.
And did they just do a regular business license for a bed and breakfast? Was it set, uh-huh. or was it a separate hospitality thing?
It was just a regular business license. They licensed as a bed and breakfast.
Okay.
And so a bed and breakfast was a short-term stay, and a short-term rentals were like 6 months to a year, or one mm-hmm. month to 6 months, and then a little longer rentals were 6 months to 1 year mm-hmm. leases normally.
So when did it start kind of, when did you start hearing more about it? Do you think there was a catalyst for it, or has it just been as time has progressed, it's kind of come more to the forefront?
There's been a whole bunch of catalysts. One, the Airbnb industry. Two, you have a lot of people who are desirous of using their property at the highest and best use.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would say, "Hey, can we rent a room, or can we rent out to our friends or our neighbors or our cousins or our relatives? You know, we ought to have the right to rent a room." And
mm-hmm.
and for years, the position was, "Hey, you can do whatever you want to your own family, And your own family was allowed to stay in with their family. Mm-hmm. But non-family rentals, a lot of people looked at as, or even non-family staying in a home, a lot of people discouraged and frowned upon that because sometimes non-family were partiers or drinkers or whatever. So mm-hmm. it was kind of policed on that. But as the world has changed and people aren't traveling as much internationally and they started traveling domestically, the demand started increasing, and so we had to look at more local things, whether they were trailer houses, room rentals, apartment rentals, short or long term. Some of the other things that cities and counties have looked at is miniature homes. Mm-hmm. Post World War II, the government got involved and built 500 to 600 square foot homes and sold them at discounts. Discounted under the VA bill for veterans who had come back and they didn't have much money to get started. So they gave them low interest loans on a little small house. And some of those three bedroom homes had three 10 foot by 10 foot bedrooms and maybe two 10 foot by 10 foot and one 10 foot by 12 foot. And so mom and dad were in the 10 by 12 foot master bedroom, and all the boys were in the 10 by 10 boys' room, and the girls were in the other 10 by 10. And some of them raised eight children, but it sure beat the log cabins from the generation before that was a 10 by 10 with 12 people in, or a 10 by 12. And people don't realize that they were in dugouts and sometimes on the floor or on a cot or just straw beds. Or America has come a long way as we've developed. In fact, as a nursing home administrator, I asked a 96-year-old lady in 1990, I said, "What's the greatest invention in your lifetime?" And she was from Hurricane, and she said, "The greatest thing that was ever invented is water by tap." She said, "As a little girl, I got tired of hiking down to the Virgin River and getting the buckets of the water for every day." And people don't realize that two-thirds of the world still hike 6 miles a day to get their water for the day. But we are pretty spoiled here in America with water on tap and roads to travel and not hike on dirt roads. And we have water and power and sewer and garbage collection. So we take care of all those things. It's nice to be in a developed country with all those amenities.
Yeah, it really is. So do you think... It sounded like you started to kind of talk about attainable housing there, or affordable housing. So what, like, do you think there's any relationship between short-term rentals and affordable housing, particularly in the Hurricane Valley area? And what is that relationship, if there is one?
Well, as a city councilman, a senior city councilman, and as a mayor, I had people say, "Oh, we don't want any... low-income housing, we don't want any poor housing, we don't want any attainable housing because that'll lower the price of all of our homes." Well, if you don't have low-priced housing, then how does anybody get a start? And where do we get our workforces? And how do our own children stay in town? And in fact, when 50 people showed up to oppose some affordable housing that was costing $278,000 to $369,000 in 2006, I thought, you're opposing what most of you paid for your homes, and now that they're worth $278,000 to $350,000, you're saying, we don't want any affordable housing. And they didn't even realize that they were all in affordable housing when they moved to town, but they... And my question to the group of 50 was, how many of you here lived in a trailer when you were first married? 25% of them raised their hands. Mm-hmm. How many of you rented an apartment when you were first married? Another 20% raised their hands. And I said, how many of you lived with your parents? And 10 or 15% raised their hands. You know, and so how did they get attainable housing, or how did they get their start? Well, we forget that we all aren't born in big homes with parents who have tons of money to afford whatever. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to have attainable housing or you lose your workforce. And even as a mayor, when I did look into the demographics, we had 2,500 people who were single people living in Hurricane who couldn't afford homes. Mm-hmm. And so they were living four people combined in a house or renting a house and splitting the rent. Mm-hmm. Or they were living with their parents, or they were living in an apartment or a cheap rental or a room rental or a studio apartment. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of ways to, in the old cowboy way, to skin a cat. I don't want to skin any cats. But the figurative meaning of that is there's a lot of ways to solve a different problem or the same problem. And whether we have some trailer housing or we have some apartments, or we have miniature homes, or we have high-density housing, if the prices are right, then people can afford it.
Yeah.
But if the prices are too high, then that drives our own children and grandchildren out of the market, mm-hmm. as well as people who want to move to town.
Mm-hmm. So talking about like the proper role of government, what do you think? And coming back to short-term rentals, what do you think is the best way for cities to handle short-term rentals? And it seems like every city has a different policy in our county. So I'm just kind of curious how things were handled when you were the mayor, and what do you think is the best way to do it?
Well, there are several ways we went about. One, we allowed room rentals in your own room if you're there. So, and that's pretty much unlimited because mm-hmm. it's your property and you're controlling it. We also allowed it Airbnbs, one home out of 500. We kind of did that as an experiment, and then we also allowed some areas. We had developers come in and say, we want to build an area that we just want to do room rentals. Mm-hmm. Out by Sand Hollow, out by special places in town that are more attuned to recreation, and so we've allowed some of that.
So did they do that with zoning laws where they a commercial zone, or do they have a special vacation rental zone? How does that work?
We allowed certain things in commercial zones, mm-hmm. certain densities, like 15 per acre. We allowed zoning of 10 per acre, but we limited it to 10% of an area. So one of the things you don't want to do is you don't want to build like some cities do who just have an open... Anybody can do whatever. You come in and we'll approve whatever zoning you want. Mm-hmm. And some have ended up with 20 units per acre through the whole town. And then as people grow and get older, or their kids do, and there's too many people for the house or the housing that's there, then you start getting gangs and you start getting family feuds and arguments and problems. In places like New York, it can work in multiple housing if everybody's used to it. Mm-hmm. But here in the West, people moved out here who wanted freedom and expanse.
And space.
And space. And, I mean, we looked at that. The state of Utah, under Governor Leavitt and Governor Huntsman in 2000 through 2004, said, hey, you've got to plan at least 10% of your housing, low-income housing, mm-hmm. or high-density housing, mm-hmm. just as part of planning. So there were areas designated 2 miles, 4 miles, 5 miles out of town for high-density. And it's funny how some of that's been developed out because the demand was there and the need was there.
Yeah.
But then everybody came to town and said, hey, we want to develop all of our property as high-density like our neighbors did. And... You don't want everybody having high density everywhere mm-hmm. because of the 20-40 year ramifications down the road. Mm-hmm. At least that was my training as a planning commissioner and my experience as being involved in government for 24 years directly and 30 mm-hmm. plus years indirectly.
So what do you think What do you think the differences in are in roles between the state and the city? What, like, whose job is it? Is there one that's more, or do they both play? Do they work together? Like, what, state versus city?
Well,
as far as that, as housing policy, who does what, and what's the best way?
You have constitutional protections that are federal, and you have constitutional protections that are state. But you also have state legislatures that get proactive in promoting their agenda, whether it's, hey, they have friends who are developers, and, hey, we did this 20-unit per acre, 800-unit development in, let's say, Sun City. Yeah, that's a made-up name, even though there are Sun Cities around. And, gosh, we made $9 million for every 20 units because there was such a demand, and they made them for $100,000, sold them for $400,000. Anyway, long story short, you just can't allow, if you allow that or the state mandates it, and we see the state of Utah and Salt Lake City mandating, hey, up to 80 units per acre in Salt Lake area or the greater Salt Lake area. Well, if you talk to every police chief, where are your greatest crimes committed? Well, when you get too many people together, hey, I want what Joe has. I want what Sally has. You get all kinds of interactions and interdictions. And when my involvement for the years as a planning commissioner, city councilman, and a mayor was, let's get a mix and let's disperse that mix out in areas that will still provide for a workforce. And you get your seniors who sometimes say, I don't want low-income housing in my city, but then they want to go to the restaurant and have servers there. Well, if you have no low-income housing, there are no servers in town, so all the restaurants close down. So you have to kind of figure
to find
out
the balance.
A balance between everything. So we, if you really truly care about everybody, then we have to provide for everybody. And not everybody's a one percenter that makes a ton of money, or even the top 25% or the bottom 25%. And there's some good books I believe in that it says we're supposed to love everybody, not just the good ones or the smart ones, and care for each other. And I mean, even, what is it, Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49, where the Lord says Sodom and Gomorrah no longer cared for each other, especially the poor, the needy, or the homeless, or those who needed food, or those who needed clothing. And he said, therefore I had no more use for them, so I swept them away. And the remnants of those cities, they're just dust and ashes. And they figure fire and brimstone or a meteorite or meteorites or something came out of the heavens and blew up those towns. And so I guess if we all want to be crispy critters, we can be selfish. But from my perspective, I think we need, the kinder and gentler way is to, let's make room for everybody and love everybody and be kind to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. So what do you think is the ideal role of a city to prevent themselves from being crispy critters and having good practices on affordable housing?
I think their role is to provide for needs of the poor and the homeless, as well as the well-to-do people, and they can do that by zoning. And there can be one-acre zoning for real fine estates, and there can be half-acre zoning for medium estates, and there can be quarter-acre zoning and eighth-acre zoning for people who can't afford more, and there can be 10-per-acre zoning, and on a limited basis, maybe even some that are 20-per-acre zoning, but you've got to spread it out and don't put it all over through all of town and say yes to everybody, but plan the for urban sprawl and suburban sprawl and take care of the needs of all the people.
Cool. Well, do you have any other thoughts or insights about affordable housing, about Hurricane City, before we wrap it up?
Well, I've visited as a mayor small reservations where they were building 600 square foot homes, you know, and on a tenth of an acre and being very successful with that. Those are going to be starter homes. Those can be couple homes. They can be senior homes.
I just saw, and I haven't seen this on the MLS in a while, but I just saw some single family residences that are 800 square feet. They have one car garage. It's like 0.08 acres. And they are some of the most affordable things that I've seen on the MLS in a while.
Yeah. So and our kids.
Happy to see the builders responding to that demand.
Yeah, I am too. And I think you asked what's my best practice in affordable housing. I think planning and zoning for startup housing, planning and zoning for those who are single, for those who are young couples, also the senior couples and also single seniors, the widows, widowers, they need to be taken care of. And my first choice is to let the free market manage it. And only when it's not managed, then the government intervenes. But the government can manage it by planning appropriately and zoning appropriately. And as they take care of those needs, then the city can grow. When I moved to Hurricane, there was 3,500 people in town, and I asked people, well, how many of your brothers and sisters live in town? None. I'm one of eight, and I'm the only one who could get a job in town. But the mentality of many people was, we like our bedroom community, and we want to keep it a small bedroom community and keep one-acre lots and nothing more than one acre. Nothing more dense than one-acre lots. And I understand that, and I get that. I love the agrarian lifestyle, and I support that wholeheartedly, and have done a lot to protect agrarian areas in the town over the years. But I also get that other areas outside of those agrarian areas can be protected, but also be other areas can be developed for more dense housing and startup housing and workforce housing. And we've had companies that have wanted to bring 200, 300, 500 employee jobs to town, and we didn't have the housing for them, or we didn't have the 200 or 300 or 500 acre sites that they wanted with the infrastructure ready to be have their big building built in 90 days, and then they're
In business.
But we did bring a few hundred businesses to town while I was in the business, and that provided a lot of kids the opportunity to stay here. And I'm proud that Hurricane has about 70% of their children and grandchildren are still in town, because we did make room for new jobs,
for
new growth, and for startup housing for our children and grandchildren.
I'm really curious, because I heard you say your first inclination is to let the free market determine, but I feel like sometimes when I'm observing city
councils,
you know, practices, and even just the neighbors, when we're talking about it, if we had no city councils, I think we would have tons and tons more density, because there's like, because of the shortage of attainable housing, there's a huge demand for the smaller units, because that's all that people can afford. So what would you say, like, what do we say if we, I think you're absolutely right that it definitely needs to be spread out all over the place, because we don't want to have like too much of it. And I think it makes for healthier communities when we have that variety between the larger single family homes and the more dense stuff. But do you ever see the cities getting in the way of that? I feel like I see them. You know, there's such a high resistance to density, even though it does have a valuable role. I don't know. I guess I don't even have a good question about this. I just want to know, like,
do I have an answer?
Do you have an answer? Can you solve this problem?
Well, I think that's
what do you say?
I think that's the golden question, and the hard part of that answer is, where do you define the limits on the balance? You know, is the goal to average a quarter acre lot? Is the goal to average a tenth of an acre lot? And that's for the people to choose, you know, and they elect representatives for city council and for mayor according to their desires as a community. The answer is, are there solutions? Yes. The easy answer is, if we balance it and provide for workforce housing, then we can still hire the policeman, we can still hire the fireman, we can still hire the school teacher to train our children and grandchildren.
And nurses and CNAs.
And restaurant workers and service workers, the guys that change your oil mm-hmm. and service your...
Yeah, I have a good friend that was watching a documentary about... It was like a nature and environmental one. And the guy who was speaking was talking about how we are, as humans, take over the world. We are taking up a lot of our open space. And he thinks the best way to solve it is to have our cities gathered in more so that we can retain open space. And I think many people that live here love our open spaces and they want to preserve those, but they don't see the disconnect when it's time to do single-family housing policy.
I'll tell you, I'll go over four or five conflicts that we had in the time I was involved. Sand Hollow Reservoir. There were a lot of people who said, hey, we've always been picnicking and vacationing out here. We go out there every Easter. You're going to put a reservoir we've been doing this forever. And we had open discussions and discussed the pros and cons, and we decided that, hey, you know what? A reservoir actually is a recreation area, so we've just changed the recreation use mm-hmm. of the Sand Hollow area. And everybody was okay with that. But any change is hard, and we have to do education. I think Ronald Reagan was probably the best president who said, when he would get opposition about his ideas, he'd say, well, that's okay. People don't understand. We'll just have to spend more time explaining things to them. And I'm sure everybody will get aboard when they understand why we're doing what we're doing, whether it was for a humanitarian reason or a selfish reason or a make room for the next guy reason or mm-hmm. whatever. I got a lot of opposition as a mayor when I opposed and as a senior city councilman when I opposed developing out the Sand Hollow or the Sand Mountain area, which was designated in the 70s as a recreation area, and we protected it and kept it there. But we had county commissioners and other developers who, hey, we want to buy 700 acres or trade 1,200 acres or 2,000 acres. And I get that, hey, they were trying to meet those needs, but for Hurricane City, who had it in their management and in our annexation plan and future plans to protect Sand Mountain for our kids and grandkids to go out and recreate. So you have the Sand Hollow question. You have the Sand Mountain question. We have the Virgin River question. How close do you want to develop along the Virgin River? Mm-hmm. And you have the steepness of development. We like seeing our open-faced hills. Mm-hmm. And to develop on those is really hard and hard to get fire trucks up to them. But some people can afford it, but they're few and far between. And it's more expensive to develop on a hill than on flat ground. So, you know, we dealt with those kinds of balancing acts and allowed certain amounts of development in different areas. But unless the government or the city or the citizens are willing to buy the ground, then... The Constitution has protected the right of people to develop their ground, mm-hmm. but it's also protected the right of the cities to plan and zone so that the health and welfare of the overall city isn't hindered. And I think Hurricane is, the 50-year plan for Hurricane is good. I like it, but then I was involved for 30 years in developing those 50 years of plans. I know where the 50 or the 80 different city parks are planned mm-hmm. in the coming years. And what if New York had planned for 80 city parks instead of one big Central Park? You know, they'd have a lot more areas to play. And what if they'd built a Sand Hollow or a Quail Lake and protected a sand mountain so that their great-grandkids could go play on the sand dunes? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so there's a balancing act of whatever we do and however we do it.
Cool. Well, I think Hurricane's done a pretty good job, and I hope they'll keep doing that. So I appreciate you taking time to interview with me today. Did you have any other things you want to share or thoughts you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, you know what? I will add this. I'm proud to live in a country that is world-renowned for their charity. The United States of America is the number one charitable nation. And secondly, I'm glad to live in Southwest Utah, which is the number two area for charity in the world. And so I'm glad that my neighbors and friends make room for other people, and that I do it, and that we help those who are poor and needy and those who want to move in and want to be like we are. Mm-hmm. And help each other. And you know, when we had floods as a mayor, everybody got together and took care of their neighbor. When we have fires, everybody gets together and took care of it, along with the people, and the neighbors help clean up. And, you know, that's the kind of city I like living in, and the kind of people I like being surrounded by. Sorry I have a bit of a cough or cold or raspy voice today, but anyway.
No, thank you. I love what you said.
The final thought, too, is there are government programs. There's HUD programs, the Farm Home Administration, FHA, that help people get. There's Habitat for Humanity, mm-hmm. but there's also families. And I'm impressed when I hear, oh, mom and dad gave us $5,000 or $20,000 to put down to buy a house. And, you know, that's what America's all about. Mm-hmm. And I get that gets back to an ethic that I have, and that is that we love one another.
I love that. And my parents helped us get into our first house, so I'm deeply grateful for that, because I don't know that we can get in as easily now.
Yeah.
So, cool. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming today, and that's all we have for today.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Southern Utah Real Estate Podcast with Jenny Chamberlain. I hope you'll think about subscribing and give the podcast a review. If you have feedback or ideas to make this podcast better, check out my website, jennychamberlain.com, and leave me a message there.